on This Week in Enterprise Tech. ASLR gets cracked. Curtis Franklin's here to talk about RSA and the Internet of Useful Things. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 227, recorded February 17th, 2017, Cayenne by My Devices. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. To learn more about GoCD, visit gocd.io/twit for a free download. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It is the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. It's a big old world, so I'm going to need the help of my friends, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the geek in paradise, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chivert, it's a little wet, a little moist, a little rainy here in California, and I think before the show you were saying, hey, California, suck it up. Is that it?
Yeah, gee, thanks. Yeah, welcome to my world. We've been having a storm. I think the remnants of my storm in Honolulu and so forth came to California, so I guess that qualifies as a Pineapple Express, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. So we're getting a little bit of Hawaii here in California. We feel so good. Actually, no, thank you, because we needed help with the drought. Now, a man who has no drought, he is a fountain of creativity at all times, is Mr. Lou Maresca. That's right. He is the third musketeer of our co-host rotation, a good man, and, well, he always drops the knowledge on us. Lou, how are you doing up there in Redmond?
Doing well. It's actually a pretty nice week here this week. Weather's sunny and it's warm, 54 degrees. So I think it looks like we're due in for the weather that you guys are getting this weekend.
Well, gentlemen, the die is cast and we've got a great show for the Twiet Riot. Not only are we going to be going through the blips and the bytes, not only are we going to be talking about RSA, not only do we have the most pertinent news for everyone who's in the enterprise, but we've got IoT. That's right. That thing that sometimes you're scared about, sometimes you're excited by. We're going to be bringing in My Devices to show us how you should be using IoT in your enterprise. But as always, we need to kick it off with the blips. Now, for those of us who have been managing tens, hundreds, or thousands of systems in the hands of employees who are not always the most security conscious, address space layout randomization, or ASLR, has been a godsend. Sure, systems are still compromised on a regular basis, but at least malware has had to up its game to infect an ASLR-enabled system with anything approaching a high percentage of success. However, that's just changed. VUSEC, a group of Dutch researchers, has found a way to defeat ASLR that isn't just a high percentage route of exploitation, but can be run in JavaScript. The new exploit pits the hardware against itself by attacking the memory management unit. The MMU is the part of the processor that keeps track of exactly where in memory the programs are being stored by listing their location in a page table. To speed memory access, the page table is kept in the processor cache in addition to main memory. Now, while malware can't read the cache, it can write to it cell by cell. And if it happens to override a memory unit that contains any of the cache page table, the processor slows down as it gets a copy of the data from main memory. That's what the malware looks for. As soon as the processor slows down, the attacking software knows that it has hit the page table. Done enough times, and it can determine on its own its address in the cache and thereby map itself to the location in main memory. This is a deep bug that affects all major hardware and software players, essentially placing us back in the 90s before ASLR. VUSEC hasn't released any of its code, but now that the word is out, it's only a matter of time before the attack is reverse engineered and in the wild. In the meantime, block JavaScript any way you can and get ready to patch to harden software that might mitigate the risk.
Well, the heat is on and the competition is up. Dominance for voice and video conference has been spread across the market, with some of the larger contenders being Microsoft, Cisco, and Google. Well, Amazon wants some skin in the game, too. This past Monday, Amazon Web Services, who is also a sponsor of Twit, introduced Chime, a video messaging and calling software service available as a web application and on Apple iOS and Google Android mobile devices. Amazon Chime is a fully managed service that runs securely on the AWS cloud. It offers chat with room and group support, file sharing, Microsoft Outlook calendar integration, very similar to Skype, as well as Active Directory integration, meeting recording capabilities, and more. The pricing offers a free tier, just like Skype, that also allows for meetings and calls for $2.50 per user per month. Users can manage their email, domain, and user identity, while $15 per user per month tier unlocks hosting meetings with video sharing for up to 100 users at a time. Amazon Chime is a perfect example of innovation on existing technology that will help fill some of the shortcomings of other offerings. We'll have to circle back in a couple months to see how the adoption rates are trending, especially since Chime is cheaper than its competitors. Check out Windows Weekly and This Week in Google for more information.
The Federal Trade Commission busts Vizio for spying on their customers and selling the data. Consumers have bought more than 11 million internet-connected Vizio television since 2010, but according to a complaint filed by the FTC and the New Jersey Attorney General, consumers didn't know that while they're watching their TVs, Vizio was watching them. The lawsuit challenges the company's tracking practices and offers insights into how established consumer protection principles apply to smart technology. Starting in 2014, Vizio made TVs that automatically tracked what consumers were watching and transmitted that data back to its servers. Vizio even retrofitted older models by installing its tracking software remotely. All of this, the FTC and Attorney General allege, was done without clearly telling consumers or getting their consent. The gist is that Vizio probably wanted to be the new Nielsen ratings to sell viewer information to better sell streaming ads and such.
Hey, how would you like a phone that could self-destruct to protect your data? No, I'm not talking about the latest note from Samsung, but about a technology that could erase not just your data, but physically destroy the hardware without damaging its surroundings. Sound like sci-fi? It's plastic. Researchers at the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology have engineered a polymer that expands to 7 times its original size within 15 seconds when exposed to temperatures above 80 degrees Celsius. That's 176 degrees for us in Fahrenheit land. The 3.7 volts from the lithium poly battery in most portable device, if shorted through the polymer, is enough to trigger the rapid expansion. If wrapped around memory or TPC chips, the expanding plastic will crush the components, rendering them irrecoverable. DARPA has toyed with this idea of self-destructing materials, but their version was clunky and expensive. This technology, according to its inventor, could be retrofitted to current devices for less than $15. So, is that a self-destructing phone in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?
Remember stingrays? The suitcase-sized cell tower simulator device used by law enforcement to track and collect data for consumer towers? Well, it's back in the news thanks to Republican Jason Chavetz of Utah, who is looking to place new legal restrictions on the device's use. With a new Cell Location Privacy Act, stingrays essentially masquerade themselves as real towers and emit a signal stronger than those generated by authentic towers in the area, so that cells connect to it instead of the traditional towers. As Chavetz states, the abuse of cell site simulators can lead to blatant violations of privacy by anyone who can purchase such a device. The new bill adds an exemptions to the original DOJ policy preventing the use of the technology. It first requires the operator to have a warrant and be conducting surveillance authorized by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or FISC, or react into a legitimate emergency. The bill additionally prohibits the introduction of evidence in a court originally acquired by cell site simulator without a warrant, even in emergency situations. Although this won't apply to all law enforcement, it aims to start the conversation of privacy, especially emergency situations.
Hotel in Austria hacked with both guests and employees locked out unless a Bitcoin ransom was paid. Furious hotel managers at the Romantik Sea Hotel Jägerwerk said they decided to go public with what happened to warn others of the dangers of cybercrime. The gist is the hotel guest and employees were locked out of computer systems and their hotel rooms by a hacker group on the opening weekend of their winter season with a fully booked hotel. Up against the wall, the hotel paid the 1,500 euro Bitcoin ransom to restore their systems. But this is yet another very sad story of how hackers are again spoiling the fun in life.
Now, for more than a decade, the city of Munich, Germany, has been the poster child for the open source software movement. Not only was it a major organization ready to switch to an open source solution, but as a 2003 study predicted, they knew that it would be more expensive than the equivalent proprietary solution. In other words, they chose Linux and open source tools not because they were cheaper, but because it would give them a strategic independence from software suppliers. The migration to open source software was completed in 2013 with about 15,000 staff members moving from Windows to a custom version of the Ubuntu distro, but now they're going to move back. This past Wednesday, they officially voted to move to a mixed Windows-Linux environment. Their excuse was that not enough employees were able to make the move between the two operating systems seamlessly, and this was the way to move forward. A lot of open source advocates are decrying the move, saying that it's a move backwards, but at least for now, open source will need to find a new poster child. That does it for the blips. We're going to get over to the bites, but first, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, I want to talk to you developers out there for a moment. I know your jobs are really, really hard. You have to deliver perfectly every single time. Your reputation, your job is always at risk, and the schedules are absolutely crazy. We've gone from a time where development cycles range from months to years to now days and weeks. Well, what's a good developer to do? Thankfully, we've got the answer for you. That's because This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD. It's an on-premise, open-source, continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks that can soothe your deployment headaches. GoCD gives you the ability to model complex workflows across multiple teams with comprehensive pipeline modeling. With GoCD, you can model both parallel and sequential execution. That lets you configure dependencies for fast feedback and on-demand deployment. GoCD's fan-in, fan-out dependency management always does the right thing, saving you resources and avoiding spurious builds. Now, what does this mean? In a word, visibility. Their value stream map lets you track a change from commit to deploy at a glance. You get a complete picture of deployments across your organization so that you can be agile in your response and see issues before they become problems. But most of all, it means that you always know what's going on with your deployment. GoCD also offers complete customization for your software's individual needs. It can perform tests written in most languages or frameworks with detailed logging, telling you exactly which change set and on which platform a test started breaking. And you can compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when troubleshooting a broken pipeline. GoCD is also fantastically flexible. It supports audible deployment. It lets you delegate the configuration of pipelines to users without full-blown admin privileges, meaning that people will only do what you let them do. It has extension points that let you connect any of a number of ready plugins or plugins that you can write yourself. All of this adds up to saying goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. If you are a developer, if you struggle with deployment, or if you're just looking for a better way to work, you owe it to yourself to try GoCD. Say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. To learn more about GoCD and for a free download, visit gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Cheever told us that he had a special invite to drop by the NASA campus to take a look at what they were doing, and he brought us this report from his field trip.
In 2007, the National Research Council released Earth Science and Applications from Space, National Imperatives for the Next Decade and Beyond, which reviewed and summarized the current state of Earth systems in the context of societal changes. On February 8, 2017, National Press gathered to see presentations on space, airborne, Earth, and ocean observational systems. The hyperspectral infrared imager called HiSPIRI, the ER2 high-altitude airborne science platform, cooperative research on volcanic plume mapping using ground and balloon-based spectrometry, and an autonomous kayak used for mapping the effects on reef systems. The bottom line is that NASA is combining multiple science platforms to fine-tune observational models on the effects of eruptions from Kilauea since 1983 on Earth, air, and ocean ecosystems. These increasingly targeted observations provide for adjustments of existing mathematical models to better predict the effects of aerosol plume disbursement, be it from nature or mankind. What follows is a collection of videos from a combined space, air, earth, and ocean-based science projects that are all part of the NASA science teams worldwide.
And right now the scanning mirror is pointing in the direction my finger is pointing, to the horizon. And then a little servo motor in here will move the mirror so that the light intake moves up as my finger is moving to zenith, to straight up. And it will keep doing and repeating that on and on, and scanning through the plume that is in that direction near the horizon. So it will take in light that has gone through the plume. We'll be measuring the absorption of SO2 gas with the spectrometer as it modifies the light that hits the spectrometer.
Give me a 10 count and then just come back to my center.
So what we're looking at here is a visualization of the scan as it's going on. There's a hemispheric diagram here, and there's a line that's moving through slowly. So that's the scan direction.
Okay, so this is a radiometer buoy. What it does is it floats on the surface. This is a flotation device up here on the top. All of this is above water. Everything else is below water. This measures downwelling light from the sun. This sensor here measures upwelling light from the coral and water column and anything else that's below it. And this sensor down here measures water depth, because you need to know how much water is between this upwelling light sensor and the bottom of the ocean. So what's going to happen is this buoy is going to be towed around by that autonomous kayak right there over areas of interest through the coral reefs in Kaneohe Bay and other parts of the Hawaiian Islands. And what this radiometer buoy is going to give us is essentially the same kind of data that the Hesperi high-flying aircraft sensors will give us, but without the intervening atmosphere and without reflection from the surface of the water and things that we need to remove from the data anyway. So this is like having perfect water reflectance data that we can then interpret for coral health.
Well, for our audio listeners, what you just heard was Chebert piling an ER2, which was fantastic, and then Chebert kayaking out with some very high-tech equipment. Chebert, you want to add a little bit of commentary to that?
Well, basically, the whole gist is the science is being done not only in a satellite from space with the Hesperi satellite, but also a high-flying aircraft at 65,000 feet, the ER2, which is, yes, a U2 variant. But it's also being done with weather balloons, people on the ground, and, of course, the autonomous kayak. The cool deal is as you get closer and closer to Earth, you get more and more detail. And what they're doing is they're mapping a lot of what's happening in the Hawaiian Islands on the Vog plume coming from Kilauea, which has been erupting since 1984, for God's sakes. And so by getting more and more of this data, we can fine-tune the models so that we can better model things like gas plumes from volcanoes, but also, say, for instance, fires, radiation from, accidents. Modeling how the atmosphere works is a really big deal, and this is what this is all about, fine-tuning models.
You know, I was actually participating in a NASA junket here at we used to call it Moffitt, now it's called the Ames Research Center, but it's interesting to see how it differs on the mainland and in Hawaii. From your video, it would seem as if there's a lot of attention being paid to gathering different environmental data sets. Here, it was all about the hardware. We were just geeking out over the hardware. Do you get a sense that that's pretty much how it is at NASA? NASA has so many different campuses across not just the country, but across the world. Do you get a flavor for the particular research and the particular type of information they're gathering at each place?
I think this one was very much involved with the science because they have such close ties to the college that I work in. During the presentation, there was about three or four of us at the college, talking about the research. And the kayak was actually launching from the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. You would know it as Gilligan's Island. it was very much science oriented. Obviously, the people geeking out, we got to actually go up and touch and look and peer into the cockpit. We were not allowed to sit in the seat because that was a live ejection seat. But other than that, we were able to take pictures and talk to the scientists, talk to the pilot. It was a lot of fun. And yes, a lot of the local newsies really geeked out over the hardware.
A live ejection seat, I don't see what could possibly go wrong with that. Honestly, I think they should have let you in there. Now, we do need to move on. But before we do that, Chibert, is there a place that people can go if they want to see everything else that you saw at your NASA field trip?
Actually, I'm going to be posting that video to YouTube. And that's under ADVNETLAB. And I'm probably going to be cutting up a longer version. A lot of those clips are very long, and I'll probably extend it and do an extended version with a lot more science concentration.
Fantastic. Chibert, thank you very much for being our enterprise geek in paradise. Now, we do need to cover something that's been happening this week. This week in San Francisco has been the RSA show here in the Moscone Center. Now, we could just tell you about some of the stories that we've heard about. We could tell you about a few of the press releases that I've been getting continuously in my my email box. But rather than do that, I thought maybe we should just bring in a familiar face who could lay down the most important bits and pieces from RSA. Ladies and gentlemen, you may know him as one of the co-hosts from This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, you're in studio.
I am indeed. Rare time to get me out of the swamp and, into the... not quite as swampish place here in Northern California. But it's great to be here in the studio.
Well, this past week, you were in deep with RSA. You were there from the very beginning, correct?
I was. I got to the RSA conference Monday morning and finished up there last night. The conference itself... ended up today. It's actually ending around the time that we're doing this particular taping, but most of the things were going from Tuesday through Thursday, and that was plenty of time to get exhausted and pretty well overwhelmed with security stuff here in the city by the bay.
Well, let's talk about that, because there's going to be people in the audience who they've probably heard of RSA. It's a big enough conference that it's made the rounds. But they don't really know what it is. I mean, it's something to do with security. What's the specific focus of RSA that sets it aside from, say, something like Enterprise Connect or Interop?
Well, the big thing is that you'll hear RSA used in two contexts, because RSA is both a company that produces security items and security services. They do a lot of tokens. They're a certificate authority, all that kind of good stuff. But they began a conference a number of years ago, and it is one of, I would say, the two big security conferences in the U.S. every year. RSA happens early in the year, in February, and then there's Black Hat, because who doesn't want to go to Las Vegas in July?
It's the best time.
But this is very much an enterprise kind of show. This is big enterprise. Government is well represented there. This is not so much the researchers and hackers. This is the CISOs, the chief information security officers, talking to one another and hearing things that are going to inform their strategic decisions for the next year.
Got it. Okay. Now, RSA was the entire week, and judging from just what I received, the volume of messages I got in my inbox, it was huge this year. It was a lot of vendors taking a lot of different approaches to some of the very common security problems. What would you say would be your number one takeaway?
Well, it's interesting because I wrote an article over at Light Reading that went live today that was four words that wrapped up RSA. But I would say the number one word that I would use is visibility, because one of the things that pretty much everyone agrees on is that in the modern enterprise network, and I'm using enterprise as any really large institutional network, the CIO and even the CISO has only the most casual idea of what's really happening on that network. I heard story after story of people going in and asking the CIO, well, how many devices do you have on your network? And they would hear a number, you know, we've got 500,000 devices. If you add up all of the mobile devices, the laptops, the servers, everything, 500,000-ish. The company would go in, do an assessment, a real count, and the actual answer would be 1.3 million, 1.4 million. If they were really lucky, maybe only 800,000 or 900,000, but it was always off by at least 50% and as much as a couple 100%. And there are a lot of reasons for this. One of them is that a rule of thumb right now is that every employee in an institution is going to represent 3.5 devices attaching to the network, between the mobile devices and the laptop. The other is that this concept of IoT, the non-computing devices like sensors and controllers and all that, they're proliferating in ways that people don't understand. There are those sensors and those controllers and devices where people don't realize they're existing. You know, the other thing that they're having trouble with visibility on is what those devices are doing, because cloud services is another area where you hear some great stories where a CIO will, if asked, tell you that they have, call it 200 approved cloud services that everyone in the organization is able to use, and they have locked it down. Those 200 cloud services are the only things that are allowed. They do an assessment and find out that there are actually 1,400 cloud services. 1,400 to 3,000 separate cloud services is a common number when you talk to people who are doing security research. Now, I'm surprised by this because I frankly didn't realize there were 3,000 cloud services that people could attach to. But once you allow people onto your network, they're going to attach to the cloud because they feel like they need to get their job done.
That's a very good point. And actually, I'm going to bring Cheebert in just a bit to talk about that visibility into cloud services, because we are finally getting comfortable with saying, yeah, cloud services are a perfectly usable option for growing out infrastructure if you don't want to have to build it yourself or if you want to stay agile. But I think that transparency question becomes very, very important when you start hooking into those services, because they're also hooking into you. But I want to start with Lou. Lou, I know that a while back you were talking about this visibility problem with one particular type of device. There was some scuttlebutt around, was it called MedJack or MedPack?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things, there's a bunch of vendors there, obviously. There's some cool things like IBM Watson doing some data mining and so on around an invasion and stuff, detection and so on. But there's some other things, like you're saying, medical device. There's a vendor called TrapX that is, they're a cybersecurity vendor that they did some research on the MedJack 3 malware that can actually modify and attach itself to connected medical devices such as MRI units and CT scanners. And so if you've ever been in a hospital before and you kind of walk past these units, on the screen what you'll notice is some of these units still have Windows XP or Windows Server 2008 kind of running on them. And you kind of have to wonder, seeing that some of those operating systems are out of their life cycle, if they have some security vulnerabilities. And since there, some of them are connected to, networks, most of the time they're not supposed to be, but some of them are connected to networks for, the data transition, transformation. You know, how vulnerable are they? And so this company showed a special attack that could actually attach itself to these services that have outdated operating systems and actually access the data, in fact, even operate the unit. And so, again, we've had several talks about this before, but, you know, this just goes to show you that, you know, unless you're, you know, following patching and you're following, you know, good security practices around isolating and sandboxing these units, you're vulnerable. And this is a perfect example, especially from a privacy standpoint.
Well, Curtis, what about that? Because I mean, that's an interesting variation on it. Yes, transparency is good. Yes, we need to know what's on our network, what's in our network, what's running through our network. But we are getting that point where there are devices that will no longer ever be safe to be on a network anywhere, and yet they still become mission critical. They still run services that we need. The transparency there is to say, yeah, these devices are obsolete. They shouldn't be on, but they are on.
Well, I think there, and believe me, there are a lot of people in the security industry who understand that. And the basic take there is that if you can't monitor the device directly, in other words, if you can't put an agent on that device, then what you have to do is be very diligent about monitoring the traffic to and from that device. So if something goes to that device, a type of traffic that you know it shouldn't have, let's say, or the device requests traffic that you know it shouldn't have. Let's talk about a thermostat with no human interface that starts requesting a lot of port 80 traffic. It's probably not doing a legitimate web browsing task. So at that point, if you watch that kind of traffic, you can shut it down. Which leads us to another issue, and that is, you know, on this visibility, there are a lot of companies out there that will give you an assessment. They'll do a snapshot in time. But do you really need to be doing constant monitoring? And I think that most companies will say yes, but that becomes a complex and expensive process. And we've talked about it before here on TWiET. All of security is a risk-reward assessment. You know, how much risk can my institution bear? And once you get to visibility issues, those discussions become very pointed because all of these things have dollar signs attached.
Right. All right. Let's go to the other side. So let's stop talking about devices that probably shouldn't be on the network anymore and talk about services that we are deliberately connecting to our network. Chibert, what about the point that Curtis made on the fact that there are so many web services that we can now hook into, legitimate ones, that perhaps we don't really consider when we think about where our data is going? It's so easy now for me to open up my data in an unintended way that it sounds like this transparency that Curtis speaks of requires a different level of auditing.
Yeah, and I think one of the big issues is, you know, even though there are lots and lots and lots of cloud services out there, a lot of these cloud services aren't always delivering the same level of auditing and protection, shall we say. Some of the cloud services I've seen do provide ways of having things like, you know, virtual taps and things like that, so you can actually do significant levels of watching traffic. And some of them really don't provide you much more than syslog, which is, you know, that's even syslog starts becoming a problem unless you've got some sort of good data mining tool like Splunk or something like that. So the reality is I have a tough time with people just saying, well, it's in the cloud, it's secure enough. Well, are you really? Because then we can have an entire conversation about certificates and how some certificates are better than others, things like that. I'm very fond of the conversation that we had with Lou about HTTPS, you know, direct connect and things like that. The problem I have with that particular technology is how much of a pain it is to get separate certificates. The knee-jerk reaction that a lot of cloud vendors have is that we're going to put a group certificate on there so that if one is, you know, not so well secured, that kind of opens up the entire group. Narrowing it down to individual certificates does make a fairly decent difference in the level of security on direct connects. But having a certificate period is a good thing. So yeah, there's a lot of different variations, and I'd like to actually address all auditing, HIPAA, SARBOX, whatever's, the level of what happens is really dependent upon a human that's involved. the checklists that I've seen vary widely depending on who's doing the auditing. So in the classified world, we actually have national standards for auditing, but I have not really seen that in the HIPAA world yet. So yes, you have to have encryption, but I've seen some people actually say, well, I'm using DES encryption. That's good enough. No, it's not. DES, triple DES, and so forth. Even AES 128 have been cracked. So yeah, I'm sorry. The HIPAA is great. It's a great first step, but there needs to be more standardization.
Indeed. We do need to move on because I want to get to our guest. They're going to give us some great knowledge, but people are going to want to know a bit more about your RSA field trip. I'm sure we're going to be bringing guests in from your experience at the show into future episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech. What do you want to leave with the Twite Right?
I think the big thing that I want to leave is that we're getting into an era when everyone recognizes that the systems themselves have to become far more intelligent. Threats, attacks are coming too fast and in too sophisticated a form to just be putting out logs that a human being can scan and then respond to. The system has to respond, and there are a lot of systems talking about that. The threats are amazing. Security is also looking at how they can become a way of adding value rather than just being a cost center. I talked, for example, to some folks in the DNS world who dealt with how they can make the enterprise more efficient, more effective, as well as more secure. Now, to find out more about this, I did, in fact, write this, and I'm going to be writing some more about it. Go over to lightreading.com, search on my name, Curtis Franklin. You can find my pieces there. If you're looking at your screen right now, you see a photograph of my very attractive face there next to today's story. Would love to have you there, and would love to have your comments on it. Tell me if you think I got it right, if you think I got it wrong, and what you'd like to see next.
Curtis, thank you very much. Thank you for doing that work, and thank you for slogging through the rain to bring us the RSA good news. Can you stay with us for the rest of the show?
I will look forward to it.
Fantastic. We do have to say goodbye right now to one of my regular co-hosts because, he's a busy, busy man, folks. I mean, that hair, that doesn't just happen. Lou, I do want to cut you loose. I want to be very, very conscious of your time here. You're going to be back with us, I think, either next week or the week after. Where can people find you if they want to see your work?
Well, you can always find me on Twitter at LouMM. And, of course, all my work I do here at Daily at Microsoft is crm.dynamics.com.
That's Lou Maresca. He is part of the triumvirate of Twite presenters. And we'll see you next time, my friend.
Thank you, guys.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for my favorite part of every episode. I mean, I love talking to my friends. I love talking to my co-hosts. I love going over the news that affects everyone in the enterprise. But my favorite time is when we get to bring in guests, experts in their field who can drop knowledge on the Twite Riot. And today I am very happy to welcome Jake White and Benny Estes. Jake is the VP of Corporate Communications and Partner Relations at My Devices. And Benny Estes is, how did you describe it? He is the wind beneath your wings. He is the flood who washes away all the darkness.
Absolutely. And also like the face of Cayenne. You know? Look like the face of Cayenne.
Hey, unfortunately, at this moment.
Now, gentlemen, really quickly, our audience has been teased with this a bit. Cayenne. We're talking about Internet of Things. What is Cayenne? What is My Devices?
All right. Well, at My Devices, our goal is to simplify the creation of IoT. I know that sounds quite daunting, but we in speaking with companies, we realized that we were hearing a common theme. Everybody wanted to take advantage of IoT, but they just didn't know how to get there. Where do I start? How do I bridge this gap from an idea that I have to prototyping all the way to a commercialized solution? So that's why we developed and launched just over a year ago a product called Cayenne, which is an IoT project builder. Really simple, easy to use, drag and drop IoT project builder.
Yeah, and Cayenne, you can think of Cayenne as sort of what we came out with. So we launched it a year ago, and we kind of told the world, we are My Devices. We've been building an IoT platform and developing infrastructure and so on for 3.5 years. And it has now come to fruition with a free project builder that we call Cayenne. So that's how you can kind of make the distinction of my devices. So the company Cayenne is the product that we give to everyone for free to use.
And the product has actually evolved from when we launched. We started really addressing the maker community. We integrated with the Raspberry Pi. Then we added Arduino. And then just last month at CES, we launched our IoT Ready program, which is a really great opportunity for hardware manufacturers, any device, any hardware manufacturer, to bring their device and actually bring it inside of Cayenne so that our hundreds and thousands of developers have the ability to drag and drop all of these different sensors, microcontrollers, gateways. We also have a large number of connectivity partners. So now we really have taken the complexity and that long time to market out of many, many developers' hands. And it's been really well received since we launched this. We have over 100,000, 150,000 downloads last week, right?
Yeah, signups for the platform. Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about this because you've found an interesting approach to getting Internet of Things devices online. You've actually taken one of the most difficult parts for the young developer, which is figuring out exactly how they're going to get this on to the device and what kind of useful information they can pull off of it. I do want to mention, especially to our audio listeners right now, the reason why they don't have a beautiful sounding mic and they don't have two cameras is because currently Los Angeles is underwater and evidently they're in their backup studio. So you're going to have to forgive them for that. Don't hold it against them, please. But gentlemen, tell me about this. When someone starts thinking about developing an IoT device that's useful, I'm not talking about internet-connected vending machines or internet-connected, you know, dryers, which are kind of cool but not great sources of usable data. What is the biggest challenge? What is the thing that makes new developers look at and say, no, I'm not going to do that?
I think it's the complexity and the time that it is required. Also, the ability of coding and hooking up all of these devices and the learning curve to do that. What we've really done is taken out that hard work because we pre-provisioned all of these devices that they can use from a library of multitudes of different types of sensors, actuators, and controllers. And so they can simply drag and drop that relatively code-free and do what they want to do, which is, I want to make something. I want to create this innovation. I want to be innovative in this in my space and get it to market. And so we've really helped them evolve and get that product commercialized.
Yeah. And
I think that's the hardest.
Yeah. And it's kind of a combination because when you think of any really, whether it's a low level or a very complicated like IoT project, it ends up being a marriage of hardware and software. So we're a software company. So really we've also kind of taken a dive into at some level, even into hardware. So for example, for like Raspberry Pi or Arduino, we really ease the process of getting those devices connected to the internet and reading data from any sensor that's connected. Now, of course, there is a hard part of actually figuring out how to wire the sensors and read data from the physical hardware. But from the software side, we provide device drivers that get installed with the agent that gets installed on the device. Or if it doesn't actually have an operating system like the Raspberry Pi, it's just a microcontroller like the Arduino. We actually provide code samples that you can copy and paste, flash directly to the device, and it will connect to the internet automatically. So it's really all about simplifying the experience for people who are trying to build projects, because there's a lot of pain in building these projects.
Looking over your hardware page, I saw a lot of I2C devices. I saw a lot of embedded devices that I use right now. And I love the idea that you can take what I've learned about those platforms and then turn it into a better device, an internet-connected device. But we could talk about this forever, and we could throw on a lot of buzzwords, but our audience gets very impatient. So why don't you take us to the demo? Show me how I'm going to use this on a Raspberry Pi or an Arduino.
You got it. You got it. So I'm going to go to my demo machine now. I assume you can see it. I think you can. So what we're viewing right now is Cayenne. This is the dashboard, and each widget that we're seeing represents a data point that is being read from, in this case, a Raspberry Pi. Now, I have another device on this account, my Arduino, which is reading humidity data. I have a soil moisture sensor as well as temperature. And all of my widgets can be dragged and dropped, and I can kind of create a customized dashboard based on the device. I can also, you can see these tabs up here, create a project view where I can actually, in fact, we'll just do this just because I like live demos better than canned ones. I can actually go and drag different sensors that I've connected. Doesn't matter which device. And I can now create a dashboard of various devices and control them from anywhere in the world. And I can make it look however I want. Each widget itself, you can see this widget looks different than this widget. Each widget has particular settings that can be modified by the user. So, for example, if I wanted to change the range that the gauge reads would change color at, I can do that here. We also store data. So it's not just visualizing data, but it's actually storing the data and viewing it over time. So, for instance, here's our history graph here, where you can see the actual processor data that's streaming from the Raspberry Pi. Nice. Adding a device is very, very simple. So we have a whole library of sensors, actuators, and different devices that can be added. And we could touch on LoRa. This is probably, we could do a whole nother session on LoRa devices. So I hesitate mentioning this, but if you want, I'll let you take the lead on asking me about LoRa if you really want to get into that. I do kind of have a surprise that I'd like to try out here. If you're willing to participate. So we can actually do a live trigger and alert. I'll show you the text message that comes in. So what we allow our users to do is not just visualize the data, but we actually take that data, we process it, and we can perform actions based off the data that comes streaming in real time. So what I've done is I've dragged my device over and I've selected a temperature data. And now what I can do is I can select an action to perform. Now I could, for example, if the temperature goes above 86 degrees, I could turn on the buzzer, I could turn on the heater, or I could restart my device. But what I could also do is I can send a notification, which is what I'll do right now. And it's very, very easy. I could send a text message. Whoops, add my recipient. And we'll just say this as test. And if I save that trigger saved. Now, in order to make that trigger fire, we'll manipulate the data a bit. We need to make that temperature sensor rise. So I have a heater that is hooked up at the offices. So if I turn the heater on, what we're going to do is we're going to go look at this temperature widget, which the heater is pointed directly at. And you're going to see it rise fairly rapidly. So it's at 72, 73, 75. I forgot what I set the threshold at. But once it does actually reach that threshold, if you want to pan back and view I can show you the phone where the text message is going to actually appear.
Yeah,
here.
Just hold it up and we'll switch back over. So you get a little warning.
Yeah. So let's wait for it to pop up.
We're getting a lot of glare from the screen. Oh, yeah. Like, hold it off at an off angle.
Okay. And so there text message just came in. Let's see here.
Nice. BMP
reached the threshold temperature of 86 degrees. This is connected to demo board 2. So that literally is the best demo that I can explain of how easy it is to connect a sensor and start doing actions and making triggers off of whatever you connect, really.
What I like about this is you're taking a lot of the guesswork out of IoT. And also this is actually a positive feedback loop, because when people can see the data being represented properly, it actually changes the way that they design the IoT devices in the first place, because you start to figure out which data is most useful and you design your devices to collect that data. Now, tell me, how well does this scale? I mean, this is one device. But if I'm dealing with an IoT deployment, we've got HiWeb in the chat room saying, look, he deals with hundreds, thousands of these things. How would I control that many devices trying to give me the same data points?
So that is a question that we get asked day in and day out. You could ask our business development team how many times they get asked that question. And we have not yet pushed that feature set, if you will, or that ability for users to actually do that, but we are developing that capability where there will be permission levels, admins, and the ability to manage and provision thousands of devices, because ultimately that is where IoT is going to go, is where it's thousands of devices deployed across a city, across some farm or whatever it is.
And we have really started moving into that commercialized space where we are working with companies to develop proven enterprise large-scale solutions, like a restaurant monitoring solution where, you know, the restaurant owner would know if their freezer has gone below a certain threshold or the door has been open for too long, receive triggers and alerts. We also have been working with a really large ag company to develop some cattle tracking, you know, basically asset tracking. We can track anything. So let's track cattle. And so we have GPS sensors, you know, on large herds of cattle, also temperature monitoring, so we can monitor their health or fever detection. So we are, the platform was developed to handle and take on these finished IoT solutions. We do partner with other companies in that development. And so you can use Cayenne in that develop prototyping stage and then also for these large scale deployments in the future.
Yeah. And if I could just add one thing, that's also why we pushed everything I showed you is completely free. Anyone can sign up and build projects and have their data stored and use our triggers engine and scheduling engine for free. And the reason we did that is because we don't just want to talk about it. We want to actually show that we have the capabilities to scale. We can handle thousands, hundreds of thousands of devices that are connecting to our back end, and we can manage them efficiently. So that's why we have thousands of users right now that are online right this second and creating events and things like that.
See, this is how I picture the IoT, how it should have been created, which is, look, there's no reason for you to spend all the time customizing each and every single device. It should be, here's a Raspberry Pi, I'm putting a base loading system on it, and all the smarts are handled by the back end. I think that would have been a much better approach. I want to bring in my co-hosts here because they're I see them in our private chat and they're just going crazy. They want to talk. Kurt, Chibert, I'm going to get to you in a bit. But Curtis, I know you had some issues about the security concerns, because anytime we hear about IoT, we all know the jokes, the Internet of Own things, the Internet of Hacked things, the Internet of Insecure things. So that's always going to be at the forefront.
It absolutely is. And, you know, these days, after things like the Krebs DDoS attack and the attack on Dyn, where IoT devices were used as part of the botnet, you know, the Mirai botnet, we're both trying to protect the IoT network and protect the rest of the world from the IoT network. So there were a couple of things that you mentioned that I'd love to just ask about. One of them, you said you were talking about storing the data so that it can be analyzed later. Where? Is that on your cloud service?
We use AWS as our, I guess, our cloud.
Okay, that's very cool. And with all the very neat programmatic widgets that you have there on your dashboard, I've got to ask, have you thought about having one that adds encryption to the data flow? Is that something that has crossed your radar screen at this point?
So before I continue talking, I'm not the technical expert here. We probably should have brought in, you know, our head of engineering if we're going to continue talking security. But all of our data is encrypted, both uplink and downlink, and everything that we can do to make sure that our users' data is protected and secure, we are doing.
I noticed on your prediction show a couple weeks ago, you know, when you were talking about the complexity of IoT, and sometimes it's really messy, especially in the security sector. And I completely agree. Everybody is racing to innovate and to get these type of things. And security, you know, is sometimes that topic because it is so complex and reaching so many different layers along the stack and how we develop IoT. We're doing everything on our layer that we can to try to make it the most secure environment possible. But as you know, there's also so many other steps along the way in the whole entire IoT ecosystem that makes security a huge challenge. And I agree with you. It's one of those big, big issues that we're all going to have to deal with in this industry and really address in the near future.
I think the enabler here, and this is when I was doing a little bit of research on Cayenne, is the way that it's designed. because they're using that AWS backend, you've got Internet of Things devices that are sending information to the backend rather than what you have as sort of the default, the standard of IoT devices right now, which is they sit on the internet and they wait. They wait for you to ask them to do something. I'm sure we can get your security guy at some point in the near future to actually, you know, talk to us about that, how that actually works. But that is a much better model to secure an IoT device rather than demanding that an IoT device be able to defend itself against an attack that we haven't even thought of yet. Why not make the device dumb to the world except to send information to that back end?
No, I agree with you. I like the basic design of what they're doing. And I will say, as someone who has spent time doing embedded control programming, I love the interface. I love the concept of what they're doing. And so that's why I'm very interested in knowing, you know, the degree to which you're able to enable secure thinking, because I think that the whole notion of secure thinking is something that the IoT has been lacking in so far. So I'm glad to hear you're doing what you're doing, and hope that a lot of your users will do responsible things with it to make sure that their applications are just as secure as possible.
I'm going to do a lot of irresponsible things.
We depend on you for things like that.
This will be my weekend, actually. Now, I do need to say, we want to be honest here on the Twit TV network. We mentioned Amazon and AWS. Amazon is a sponsor of the Twit TV network. Just so you know, full disclosure. Chibert, we were doing IoT at Interop before it was known as IoT. What's your take on this?
Oh, you know, we've had sensors. You know, the Interop gang loves sensors. We actually had a completely isolated network we called the Axis Ether Network. It was strictly for things like environmental sensors, security sensors, webcams, remote power control, and things like that.
A butt sensor, if I remember properly. We had a butt sensor on the internet.
We had all kinds of things. Last year, we actually had a demo lab right on the show floor concentrating on enterprise applications of IoT. Now, lots of cool things we did, all kinds of good stuff. I started talking a little bit about LoRa, which is a long-range wireless network. What's cool is it's at a fairly low frequency, so it can go through a lot of objects. Like, for instance, some guys in California did some testing, and they got 2.3 miles through multiple office buildings, which is super cool. It's actually on some old pager frequencies, which is awesome. But the comments I got from the people that came and visited us in the demo show is they really like this. The number one blockage, the barrier to IoT in the enterprise activities that came to visit us was the DevOps cost. Spinning up a development group in order to not only develop but also then maintain an IoT solution basically has caused a lot of organizations to say, nope, not interested. But realistically, on Cayenne, it's two commands. One is a wget to bring the software down, and it's actually customized during the install process. And then the second one actually does the install and configuration and actually rolls a certificate so that it's secure. Two commands. You literally can cut and paste from the web interface into the command line on the Raspberry Pi. After that, run an iOS or Android app and drag and drop your sensors and go crazy. I'm actually going to ask Benny to very quickly show the help system, because that is what is amazing. It actually shows you the devices, pictures of the devices, and also how to hook it up on a proto board so that you don't even have to solder if you don't want to. Very fast, very easy. I would suggest for enterprise viewers, throw a water sensor under your raised floor, because that's someplace that a lot of people need sensors, but it's too expensive to deploy. Benny, how about it?
Yeah. So you mean like our documentation, right?
Yeah. I love the documentation. I think that's your number one selling point for me.
Yeah. So I just now went to our documentation page, and I'll click on getting started here. And let's see, hopefully it loads. And you can see that you simply need to create your account, choose your device, you can see there's Raspberry Pi, Arduino, LoRa. And with Raspberry Pi, it really is a matter of minutes that it takes to get started. We include videos for video help on how to actually do it. There I am showing you exactly how to do it. And as long as your Raspberry Pi is powered on and connected to the internet, there's those two commands that you mentioned, the wget and then the sudo. We will actually install the libraries, install the agent, and all software and drivers onto your Raspberry Pi to help you get started in minutes.
And Brian, this is great. I'm glad you mentioned LoRa, and I know Benny wasn't mentioning it earlier, but I do want to just let you know that we are heavily involved and supportive of the LoRa technology. We, for example, we'll be next week at Mobile World Congress in the LoRa Alliance booth, and we have brought on a ton of LoRa-enabled devices into our system. And back to full disclosure, we also just started our Series A funding and was kicked off by a sizable investment from Semtech. So just want to let you know that as far as LoRa goes, Kyan's a huge believer in the LoRa-range technology, and we have been working with them quite extensively to make sure that we can provide a cost-effective solution for the hardware manufacturers, the LoRa connectivity providers like Actility, LoRa Senate, Orbiwise, Things Network. We've really been building up a really great ecosystem in conjunction with the LoRa Alliance.
And really, we kind of touched on commercialization and thousands of sensors being connected. And that's kind of where LoRa is going, is you can have a single gateway on top of a tower in an agricultural field, and that there can be 1,000 end nodes that are sprinkled throughout a large agricultural field that are all connecting to that single gateway. And those end nodes can connect over, they've done tests up to 10 miles connecting to that single gateway. And so that really is going to empower people to realize the full potential of the buzzword IoT. I know I sometimes don't like using it either, but yeah, IoT.
Well, gentlemen, this is different. I mean, this I like getting a deeper look at an IoT system that might actually work. I do want to do this. We are way, way out of time. We're way over what we're supposed to be running. But I do have another show on the Twit TV network called Know How. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind if we did an in-depth episode or two of running Kyan, because I think it would be perfect for some of the devices that we've been working on. We've been playing with Raspberry Pi and Arduino. I think it's time people realized that IoT isn't just for the professional developers. Would it be okay if I brought you back?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. That'd be great. And especially we didn't have an opportunity today to touch on the really exciting, that's the fun part of my job, is like seeing every day new projects that people have built with Kyan in this really vast, vibrant community. So maybe we can really hit on there and show you some really cool projects that our Kyan users submit to us every day. And it's just, the creativity and the innovation is amazing.
Fantastic. Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. And you know what, Chibert, let's get them back on, hopefully when it's not doing the biblical flood in Los Angeles, so they can be in the regular studio. Gentlemen, absolute pleasure. If you could, please, please let our audience know where they can find you, where they can find my devices, where they could get Kyan onto the Raspberry Pi.
Of course. So you can just go to mydevices.com. You'll see a sign up link or a sign in link. Maybe you already have an account. It's completely free. You can get started. You can find me actually on our community. So we have a very vibrant, a very active developer community. If you click on developer tab, and then go to the forum, you'll actually see users who are talking to each other, building projects, interacting, asking for new features. I'm on there all the time. I have people who are excited and willing to help you build your project. Or you can find me on Twitter. I'm also Benny_Estes.
And Kyan_IoT. You can follow us on Twitter. Mm-hmm. See the announcements we'll be making. And there are a lot in the near future. Follow us on Facebook. And thank you so much for having us today.
Thank
you. This was a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Jake White, the VP of Corporate Communications and Partner Relations at My Devices, and Benny Estes, their personal security guru. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being part of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 non-hacked IoT devices. I want to thank our panel, of course, Lou Maresca, who has already departed because he actually has to work for a living, but also my good friends. Let's start with Chibert, since he's not in studio and he's not sharing the love that we got here over at the Twit East Side studio. Chibert, where can people find you? What are you working on? And when do we get more of your Hawaiian weather?
Well, Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, and if you toss me a tweet, I'll reply with the link so you can get my little document that I did at Maker Faire Honolulu, where I use Cayenne on a Raspberry Pi with a waterproof temperature sensor and an Adafruit controllable power strip to control a heater for a saltwater fish tank.
Very cool. It's always nice to see the technology we talk about actually in use. Chibert, you are a gentleman, a scholar, and a school bus. Speaking of school buses, you've got the color scheme, Curtis. What's going on with you? Where can people find your work?
Well, you know, I'm normally such a shrinking violet that I decided to go a little bit different today. And for someone from the swamp, it's right chilly up here in Northern California. So trying to stay warm. Aside from staying warm, I'm spending a lot of time at Light Reading doing the security stuff. So if you want to keep up with what's going on in the world of big system security, please do come on over to Light Reading to find out when I'm posting there. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA. And I want to let everyone in the Twiet Riot know that coming up in the next few weeks, I'm going to be starting an exciting new project. Going to be doing my own thing under the broad Light Reading umbrella. Some cool stuff going to be happening, and I would love it if some of our regular listeners would come over and be part of that as well.
Curtis Franklin, Brian Chi, thank you both so very much. Also, thanks to you. That's right, the person who tunes in every week to listen or watch to This Week in Enterprise Tech. We wouldn't have a show without you, and we want to make it easier for you to get the enterprise goodness that you demand. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiet, T-W-I-E-T. There you will find all of our back episodes as well as a little drop-down menu. And that drop-down menu is important to us because it's our RSS feed. If you want to get the version of your choice of every show into your device of choice every week, that's where you go. You can get an audio version in your phone. You can get a video version on your tablet. You can get the high-definition video version on your laptop or your desktop so you can watch us in all our HD goodness. Again, just go to twit.tv/Twiet. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter. Just go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you go there, well, you'll find out what I'm doing when I'm not here in the studio. I'm often playing around with a lot of electronics, especially a lot of IoT devices. We've been working on a internet-connected plant automation system that I think I'm going to Cayenne enable this weekend. So again, twitter.com/PadreSJ. Also, don't forget everyone here in the studio who makes this show possible. No, not just the chat room at irc.twit.tv, not just the live events at live.twit.tv, but the people who are actually here, Lisa and Leo, who let us do This Week in Enterprise Tech, to the engineers like Kara, who make sure that all the cameras are working properly, and of course, to our director. That's right, Kevin. Kevin, do you have a mic on you?
Hi.
Okay, Kevin, we do this every week, so at some point I'm assuming you're going to get used to this. Could you tell the people at home what it is that you actually do here?
I'm the guy who reminds Burke to drink his coffee that he leaves on the counter.
Yes, yes. And along with that, also we've started a tradition of giving Kevin a chance at redemption each and every single week by asking him a question that comes from every episode to see if he was actually paying attention. And Kevin, we were talking a lot about Cayenne and about the Internet of Things, so let me ask you this. On an Arduino Uno, not the clone version, but the authentic one, how many analog pins are there?
17.
I'm sorry, the answer was 6, but thank you for playing. We'll give you another chance next week. And folks, until then, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.